think about it and how we get started. And last week we looked primarily at a Christ-centered Bible. What does it mean to have a Christ-centered Bible? And how we go about that, particularly in approaching the Old Testament. I don't think we generally struggle with understanding the New Testament is centered on Christ and so on. But in the Old Testament, we need to think quite a bit about that. And I'll pop this slide up real quickly. And we talked about the Old Testament path, the Old Testament to New Testament pathways, and how we think about that in reference to having a Christ-centered Bible. And it looks kind of like this. We start with the text. We want to understand. We want to read the text correctly. It's remarkable to me how often, you know, I listen to preaching and I think, you know, he probably read the text once and started off and never looked at it again. And then how often we read the text in terms of what we think is there, not the words that are actually there. And so, for example, I often surprise people by saying, you know that Elijah did not go up into heaven in a chariot of fire, right? The text says that the chariot of fire separated Elijah from Elisha, but Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. And so just paying close attention to the text, particularly in the Old Testament stories. And what did it mean to them then? What does the story of Samson mean to those who are, you know, moving into conquering the land and so on and during the time of the judges? What does any of these Old Testament stories mean to the original listener? Because it can't mean less than that. Right. More often than not, the New Testament takes these and expands on them so that it means more. But it can't mean less than what the original author would have understood. And then we want to move across to the New Covenant, to New Testament, to Christ. And we do so with a number of tools, particularly around the themes of the Bible and those kinds of, you know, prophecies, portraits, types, all different kinds of ways of taking us from text to the New Testament. And even in narrative, sometimes the stories themselves and the way the story unfolds is meant to help us to begin to see in a Christ-centered way. And so the common story of David and Goliath, and David is sent from his father. He's sent to his brothers. His brothers reject him. He's then confronted with by the pagan king, by Saul, and so on. And the story just unfolds and he goes down into the valley and he defeats the giant who is cursing the name of the Lord. And it's that story is told in these movements from person to person in a way that is similar to Christ's own coming to earth and so on. Now, you wouldn't know that if you were the original recipient, but reading it as a New Testament person, you hear yourself say, oh, his father sent him. Oh, he came to his brothers and his brothers reject him. By this time, you ought to be hearing John 1, right? And so on. And so then once we have a clear understanding of how the text takes us into the New Covenant, then we take the applications from there. There are some times, particularly in wisdom literature, that we can bring text directly across, as long as we recognize we're bridging cultures. And so the book of Proverbs is just Proverbs, right? You can pretty well bring that across. Ecclesiastes is, though it's embedded in a culture, it's, you know, this is a fallen world, get over it. I mean, you know, that kind of approach to Ecclesiastes. And so we talked then a little bit about, when we talk about Christ-centered, we're not simply looking for Jesus under every bush, okay? We're looking, if we're talking about a Christ-centered Bible, then we're talking about the second person of the Godhead all the way back into the ancient mists of the Old Testament, all the way into eternity future. And so the Lord existed as the second person of the Godhead. And so this is all in your supplement that we just handed out for those of you who are writing madly. So so we're looking at how does this text take us, and what to what part? It's talking about the incarnation. Is it talking about the cross? Is it talking about the resurrection? There are two or three psalms that refer, as we know now, to the resurrection. And then you have New Testament texts that will refer to this whole thing. Colossians 1, Ephesians 1. And the more of Christ's, the wholeness of who Jesus is referred to, then the higher they're elevating his preeminence. And so we think about it this way. And now this is largely at the getting it right. You know, how do you understand what the text is saying? How do you get it right? How do you study it? All right. And then I skipped this kind of, we were running out of time, but I wanted to talk briefly about this. And of course, you can really see that. Maybe you can see it better out there than I can see it on the back wall. So I'm going to put it all up. Now, one of the things that we have to do then is we have to take getting it right and we have to get it across. And so for preaching and teaching, for communicating the word, for talking about the word with others, you have to make decisions about what you're going to do. And sometimes one of the critiques of those of us who believe in a Christ-centered Bible is that we so often can go through text in the Old Testament and we leave out a bunch of stuff. And so the question becomes, well, did you see it? Well, I can't speak for anyone else, but usually there's more stuff laying on the cutting room floor than ends up in a sermon. And I get 40 minutes at most. And so, you know, so I have to make decisions. And so there is decisions that has to be made in your teaching and preaching about what you're going to do. I mean, it took me 69 sermons, I think, through 55 chapters of Genesis or 54 chapters of Genesis. And I left a whole lot of stuff on the cutting room floor. And we talked about Samson. I mean, Samson is interesting because where and when is Samson a type of Christ? Is it in every part of his life? I mean, Samson's a disaster. And he's just this walking covenant breaker. And so is there a contrast? Yes, Jesus is a covenant keeper and Samson was not. But the point of Samson is at the very end when he pushes out the pillars and the pagan temple falls in. And there's the one line. Samson in his death killed more Philistines than he had in all of his life. Well, that points us to Christ, doesn't it? Christ in his death defeated Philistines representing the anti-God nations around Israel. And so if I'm preaching, where and when do we start referencing the Lord? If you're teaching it in a Bible study, if you're helping someone understand the story of Samson, when do you go? You make decisions. And yes, there are other places to go. And I've illustrated already some ways to not do Samson. So we don't dig the honey of the gospel out of the slain lion of the tribe of Judah. And if you don't know what I'm referring to, then go back and read the story of Samson. So then we're looking at, and so as we preach and teach, we have purposes, we have themes, we have reasons for selecting how we're going to and which ones. And particularly in a book like Genesis, which is seedbed nearly everything in the Bible, you know, you could take almost chapter by chapter, and certainly the tell dots, the sections that begin and end with, and these are the generations of, which is how the book is divided up. You could take those and you could preach a year if you wanted to take every single Christological trajectory. Just taking certain panels would do a lot. And think of Jacob, you know. Think of this guy and how often he's referred to in the Old Testament, how often he's referred to in the New Testament, and how often we are compared and contrasted to him. Just Jacob. And then all the richness of a little bit of what we're going to talk about in terms of Abraham. The other idea that that you can't see there, I'm sorry about that, is how do we handle the imperatives of the Old Testament? Well, we don't live under the Old Testament. We are not subject to its imperatives. But why then do we find in the New Testament, for example, 1 Corinthians 10, we have these imperatives, do not covenant, do not covet, do not grumble, do not rebel, and so on. But then they go back and they follow Israel's rebellion against Moses as a leader. And why is that done? Is Paul then looking at the Old Testament and says, oh, the Old Testament says not to covet here in this text, so therefore we don't covet. I don't think that's the way the New Testament is working. The New Testament is giving you these imperatives and then illustrating them from the Old Testament. And 1 Corinthians 10 tells us these things were written for our instruction upon whom the ends of the world have come or the end of the ages are coming. And it was God ordained the order of these things in time and history and then had them written down so that as we in the new covenant look back into those, we have illustrations of what happens. And so then, you know, we are not to covet. Well, look what happens when they coveted. We are not to grumble. Look what happens when they grumble. And so they have the illustrative power. And so on. And so you can go back Old Testament story after story after story and take New Testament imperatives and they become rich and powerful and nuanced when you understand what's going on. But I don't think we, I know it's not part of our New Covenant theology is we don't go back to the Old Testament for its imperatives. The imperatives of the New Testament are what we live by. But those imperatives are hugely illustrated in the Old, meaning that they're very similar. And there are some that are not. And so we're thinking about how the Old Testament then unpacks. And 1 Corinthians 10, 1-13 is an important text. And so we're making homiletical decisions. So hermeneutics is how you study. A homiletics is how you communicate. And so in studying, you want to understand as many of those as you can. What is going on here? And how does the New Testament speak of this? And, you know, you need to master Hebrews 11, just as an example. Because you read Hebrews 11 and you go, wait a minute. And we're going to look at Abraham. Abraham walked around marking out the land of Canaan. Did he have his eyes on the ground? No. Hebrews tells us he had his eyes on heaven. That he walked around in faith obedience, but he was looking for something later, longer, bigger. That's what he was looking for. You wouldn't know that reading the Old Testament text in and of itself, except for a couple of hints. But if you know your New Testament, you know Hebrews 11, and all of those characters who by faith, but they. And so, so, you know, just understand that as you're listening to us preach as elders and others who are teaching, that one of the things that is being done is not to parade all of the things that in this text that are about Jesus, but rather how do we take you in a way that follows the storyline of what we're teaching. If I'm teaching Genesis, what am I doing? What theme am I generally following? And how does that then take me to different aspects of who Jesus is and so on? So I'm making decisions and I think everybody does it. I was thinking about this and I thought over the folks that I've profited from, talked with, we've wrestled over this stuff together, and I have access to a lot of their preaching, and Kent Hughes being someone who thinks like this, his New Covenant, thinks about his Bible this way, but you go back and read his sermons and anything that's from the Old Testament, and you will find him selecting one or two across the top to follow. But I guarantee you, Kent has notebooks full of on that text. And Dick Lucas the same way, and others who preach and teach in this vein. So I wanted to emphasize that because it's very easy to hear me talking particularly about a Christ-centered Bible, and Christ is in the Old Testament, and we're finding Christ in the Old Testament, particularly illuminated by the New Testament. And then you're looking at a text and you hear me picking one or two. The others are there and they're obvious. Well, why didn't he do those? Well, then listen for why were they selected? Because that's horizontal this way. So I think of all of those as being pillars, and there's all these stones in the bridge. You know, so here's a bridge work, here's a bridge work. But I'm doing a roadway. Now I could pause and pull out each brick that's in each pillar. It'd be tedious, and so on. It might even be exciting, I suppose, particularly if you like engineering and stoneworks and so on. But the point is in preaching is that on the scripture and from the text itself, following the line of the text and staying on the line of the text, we traverse across and follow the Lord's path in all of that. So I wanted to come back this morning and just touch on that. If you will, if you have questions, I'm going to reserve some time at the end just to hang on to your questions. And so write them down, do something like that, and then we'll pause the recording for you to ask your questions, okay? So let's pick back up if I can get there. Sometimes I was going to use my pen and battery died, so... Let's pick up then with the Noahic Covenant. And the Noahic Covenant, look at your index in the front and then go to that page. Somebody tell me what page that is. Page 5. Thank you. Page 5. I want to remind you that we are thinking then, though some would say that there is a covenant with Adam, and that's a possibility that we are open to, the first covenant in the Bible that is clearly called a covenant is in Genesis 8 and 9, and with the Noahic Covenant. And so we're looking at sort of just an overview from Genesis 8, 20 to 9, 17. And remember, it's not my aim necessarily to exposit these texts, but rather to help you see how these are unfolding. So we begin with the covenant preparation in Genesis chapter 8. And remember, this is after the flood, after the boat has come to rest, the ark, as we commonly call it, has come to rest on Mount Ararat. And they have waited until the land was largely dry, and they've exited from it. And they have had time to begin to plant and to begin to respond to the grace of God in the new world. And if our understanding of the difference between the pre-flood and post-flood, Noah walked out into a very different world. And just the devastation of the flood, much less the things that had changed in the natural order. And so we come then to Genesis chapter 8 and verse 20. And here is the Bible's first covenant that is in and of itself identified as a covenant. Now, we've already discussed the issues that surround whether there are a previous covenant with Adam. I don't believe Genesis 3:15 constitutes a covenant. It's a threat because it's said to Satan. And so in the scriptures, this is the first time that we find the words "and God made a covenant." Something to that effect. Moses, now remember, Moses is writing to Israel during the wilderness wandering. All right. Sometimes when we read the Old Testament, we think of it as being contemporaneous, as though it's being written as the events unfolded. And that's not true at all. Moses wrote Genesis sometime early in either the wilderness wandering or in the time between Mount Sinai and they first went to Kadesh Barnea. Moses' writing of Genesis is to remind Israel that they are not pagans. He is beginning to give them identity. Genesis, they are not pagans. Exodus, they are not Egyptians. Leviticus, they are gods. Numbers, what went wrong? Deuteronomy, how to get it right as they enter the land. That's the unfolding of the Torah, the five books that Moses wrote. So he's giving them their identity, and he is going through the creation myths, the flood myths, the origins myths, and he is saying, here's the truth. Here's what happened. Here's what really happened. And this is who you are, and this is what God is doing. And so he's countering the pagan myths and religions around them. In that day, almost all of the unfolding pagan myths had creation myths and they had flood myths. And so it's common because of their history. It was passed down. I mean, you can imagine an event that dramatic that was only 520 something years ago would have been passed down in oral traditions. And it was very common. But they were also very, very corrupted. And so Moses is doing that. And so he is relating the true history of what actually happened. But it is oriented toward the coming of the Messiah, and it's oriented toward the developing of the nation of Israel, and it's oriented in that way. So it is very centric on a small part of the world. There's lots of stuff going on in the rest of the world that God is at that time already positioning nations and people groups and language groups, as Paul says in Acts 17, he is already positioning them so that they are in the right place when Christ comes and the gospel goes out in the first two generations. Those nations are exactly where they're supposed to be for the initial impetus and movement of the gospel. It's a phenomenal thing to think about. So we open in chapter 8, verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird, and he offered burnt offerings on the altar. And so Noah's response to God's gracious deliverance from judgment is a sacrifice. And he offers the clean animals. He knows to do that. Remember that on the ark, there were seven of each of the clean animals, seven pairs, actually. And so that there were more of the clean animals that would have come into the world after the flood. And he knows to do this even before the law was given. This is common before the law was given. God's people knew what God wanted them to do because, absent from the Bible, God had told them what he expected. And it was passed down. Of course, Noah is a godly man, his family. And so sometimes people ask me, you know, if I'm related, because my last name, am I related to, you know, the president? I say, well, only by Adam and Noah. Really, when it comes down to it, only by Noah. At the end of the day, it's kind of strange to remember that the whole human race came from one man and his children. And then you find then, secondly, the Lord's inner determination, chapter 8, verses 21 and 22. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And so in this new world that emerges out of the flood, as God smells the sweet smelling sacrifice, then there is this internal declaration that is given to us about God's intention and what he is going to do and what he is, in this case, not going to do. And so then in chapter 9, verses 1 through 17, now part of what Moses is doing, man, there's so much here. Part of what Moses is doing is to show, first of all, that God is interacting with the real world. All right. So God is totally other. He is not like us. He is not created. He always is. And yet, his interaction with what he has made and who he has made is real. It's not an illusion. It's not imaginary. He's actually interacting with the world in time and space. And it's another one of those great mysteries, isn't it? That's settled in the incarnation. Jesus is human and divine, and there is a real union between the human and divine, but not in a way that confuses them or mixes them. And here we go again. Here is God dwelling in eternity, wholly other, not created, always self-existent, and, oh, that's sweet. I will not do this again. You see, he's interacting with the world. And Moses is showing us that what God covenants and promises comes out of inner determinations and purposes. This is not random. This is not ad hoc. God is thinking and intending. There's a design. And so as the covenants unfold, they are unfolding. We should be asking ourselves right away, what is God's internal intention when he gives this covenant? Because we see from the Noahic covenant, it's introduced this way. We hear God thinking. We hear God talking among himself. And just as we did at creation. So then in chapter 9, we have the covenant proper. And here is the covenant, verse 1, chapter 9, verses 1 to 7. And God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens and upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea." That's a practical implementation of human dominion over the earth, isn't it? "And into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. As I gave you the green plants, pre-flood, I now give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it. From man and from his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you be fruitful and multiply and increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it." Now, do you see right away that there's a bookend, right? Increase, be fruitful, and multiply at the top. Increase and be fruitful and multiply at the bottom. Okay, so this is the top and bottom of this covenant. So in verses 1 to 7, then, we have its law, if you can put it that way. Its requirements. And so God says that you are to do this. It's an imperative. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. This is what they are to do. Which is why the building of the tower at Babel, in order to not scatter, is direct rebellion against the command of God. They were not only to be fruitful and multiply, but they were to fill the earth. That doesn't mean have people every 3 feet. That means as people and as you multiply, spread throughout the earth, because you're going to exercise dominion over the whole earth, is the sense of it. And then there is the permission as a part of the law to eat meat. It seems that up until this time, man was not permitted to eat meat. I think pre-flood they did. Why would man suddenly, you know, who disobeys God and just about everything else, go, God said not to eat meat, so I won't. I'm sure they did, but they did it without permission. And so God is explicit here that he has now given the right to the ability to eat meat. And but there is a negative command, verse 4, "You shall not eat the flesh with its life." And so the consuming of meat with the blood still in it. And so here comes the beginning of what we think of as kosher laws. And but the idea here is to respect life. The whole thing is about respecting life. So be fruitful, multiply, be fruitful, multiply. That's about life. And then having permission to eat meat is elevating human life above animal life. And so there should not be this equivalent that there is no difference between human life and animal life. And then thirdly, there is this accounting. There's the respecting of life. There's accounting that is held because both animal kingdom among humans. And so there's this parallel structure that is given in these verses. And the parallel structure runs like this. In verse 1 and verse 7, there is a general precept to fill the earth with people. And in verse 7, there is a personal precept. So generally, and then to Noah and his sons. And then in verse 2, there's protection for humans from animals. They are going to fear human beings. And then in verses 5 and 6, parallel to that, there is the protection of human life from other humans. If an animal kills a human with an intent, then that animal is to be destroyed. It's that simple. And if a human killed another human, the rest of the Old Testament unfolds the idea of intent on purpose, accidental death. You know, manslaughter was treated differently, particularly in the Mosaic Law. But the whole point is, after God has wiped out all human life, except for 8 persons, we come out and emerge in the new world, and now human life is being protected. Why? Because God said, I will never do this again. Do you see it? You see how that's... I mean, wouldn't it have been easy for people to say, well, if God wiped out the whole human race, then why can't I kill other human beings? God says, no, you know, and then in the center of it, there's the permission to eat meat and plants, verse 3, and in verse 4, they are forbidden to eat blood. And so here is the sense of the law. And so you get the protection of life, you get the sense of a positive command and a negative command. And the whole point here then is that this is serving God's intent not to bring the kind of judgment on the earth by water as he did in the flood. And then there's the second part of the command. The second part of the covenant, we have its promise in verses 8 to 11. Then God said to Noah and his sons with him. Now notice that this is not merely with Noah, but it is with his sons, future representatives of the human race. God said to Noah and to his sons who were with him, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your offspring after you. Both of these are plural. And with every living creature that is with you, the birds and the livestock and every beast of the earth with you, as many as come out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. Here is God's promise. This will not happen again. That all human life, all human and animal life, would be destroyed. And so we see its recipients, and it's given to human beings, but it's about all that came out of the ark and the preservation of life. Now, this preservation of life then becomes a very important motif all through the Bible. And therefore, it is pointing to the fact that when the Messiah comes and his life is taken, that there is a great consequence for that. And so the covenant is a unilateral promise to all humanity. Human beings don't have to do anything. This is just simply what God is going to do. So God will never again destroy all life by water. And so we see its recipients, the humanity and the animal kingdom, particularly the species that went into the ark, and we see its content. God will not destroy by flood again. Now, this text is actually alluded to in the New Testament. And so if you turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3. Peter writes, "This is now the second letter that I am writing to you, beloved. In both of them, I'm stirring up your sincere mind by way of reminder that you should remember the predictions of the holy prophets and the commandment of the Lord and Savior through your apostles, knowing this first of all, that scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing and following their own sinful desires. They will say, 'Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep,'" in other words, ever since the patriarchs died, "all things are continuing as they were from the beginning of creation." The denial of catastrophism, right? Effectively, a denial of the flood, a denial of judgment. Where is God coming? After all, things have never changed since creation. God does not judge. We can live any way we want. That's the implication. "For they deliberately overlook this fact, that the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God, and that by means of these, the world that then existed was deluged," or covered "with water and perished. But by the same word, the heavens and the earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and the destruction of the ungodly. But do not overlook this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord one day is 1,000 years, 1,000 years is one day. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, is patient, not wishing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come. It will come like a thief. And then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned and dissolved, and the earth will, and the works that are done in it will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in the lives of holiness and godliness?" And so on. There was a world that then was, the world that now is, and there is a world to come. World that then was created out of waters by the word of God, was overflowed with waters and perished. We now live in a world that is reserved for judgment by fire, which then most of the New Testament attest to in different ways. So God kept his promise. It's just interesting how Peter looks back at that text and says, you can't look at all these long time that Jesus has not returned and say, judgment's not going to happen. Oh no, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's just not going to happen like that. It's going to happen like this. And since that's true, that's not just a theological fact. How ought you to live? This has huge implications for how you ought to live. Verse 13 of that text in Peter. "But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells." So we're waiting for something new. And okay, so what then? We said a covenant has this sense of law, promise, responsibilities, commands. And then it has a promise he will not judge. So what is its sign? Verses 12 through 17. Back to Genesis chapter 9. "And God said, 'This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth.' And God said to Noah, 'This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth.'" And so there is a rainbow here on earth, which is the sign of this covenant. Were there rainbows before? Probably. But for sure, God takes this physical phenomenon that happens when there's sunlight shining on raindrops and gets a prismatic view. Yeah, how do you like the science to destroy the beauty of the bow? But anyway, it's kind of like dissecting a butterfly, right? But here is this beautiful bow that God sets, and he says, every time you see it, you remember my promise. There's a promise that I will not judge in this way. But there is also, Peter says, there's a promise that God will still judge. God is patient and long-suffering. So it's this rainbow, then, this sign is a natural existing physical reality. It is assigned a special spiritual meaning. And it is to comfort man. When we see it, we remember that God will not do this again. And it is to remind God in human terms. Now, it's not that God can forget, and I know that this is another whole topic that's not in our purview. But there is a sense in which the Bible speaks of God in human terms, so that we have a sense of the reality, and I think it's anticipating the incarnation and so on. But there is just a sense. I've said it there as a reminder. Now, so we have a rainbow on earth. Judgment is past. But you know, the rainbow exists in the rest of the Bible in an interesting way. So there is a rainbow in heaven. And the rainbow in heaven means judgment is coming. Look at Ezekiel 1, 26 through 28. This is when the Lord appeared to Ezekiel in his portable chariot, his portable throne. Amazing text. And in describing that, listen to a part of the description. Above the expanse over their heads, that is the four cherubim who were carrying the throne, there was the likeness of a throne, an appearance like sapphire. And seated above the likeness of the throne was a likeness with a human appearance. Do you get the idea? It's not a clear picture. Like this, and it's like that, and it's like this. And upward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw it were gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire, enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw as it were the appearance of fire, and there was brightness around him. And like the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain, it was the appearance of brightness all around. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face and I heard the voice of one speaking. So here is the rainbow over the portable throne of God. In Babylon, right? Ezekiel's in Babylon. He's not in Israel. God is not a tribal God. And here is the throne. And so here is this rainbow. And so judgment in Noah. And now the rainbow appears over this personage who comes to Ezekiel. But then notice in Revelation 4, we have that same rainbow over the throne in heaven. Revelation 4, 1-3, and after this I looked, and behold, a door standing again open in heaven. And the first voice, which I had heard speaking to me like a trumpet, said, come up here, and I will show you what will take place after this. At once I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne stood in the heaven, with one seated on the throne, and who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian. And all around the throne was a rainbow that had the appearance of an emerald. And so there's a sort of biblical theology of rainbow, of I will not judge, of I have come to you in the midst of judgment, Ezekiel. And now in the end of days, here is Christ on his throne, and there's this massive rainbow around about him, in which there is the promise of redemption for his people, and there is the promise of execution for those who do not believe. And then the final in this biblical theology of rainbow is in Revelation 10. And it is around the head of the mighty angel. Revelation 10, and then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven, wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head. His face was like the sun, his leg like pillars of fire. He had a little scroll open in his hand, and he set his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land and called with a loud voice like a lion roaring. And when he called out, the seven thunders sounded. And so at the very end of days, here stands this mighty angel who is unfolding the wrath of God, releasing the wrath of God, and protecting some and unfolding on other. And what is around his head but a rainbow? So there will be no more judgment like this. And I come to you to comfort you in the midst of judgment in Babylon. And here is Christ on his throne ruling as the one of both redemption and judgment with the rainbow about his head. And when it is executed, the mighty angel, depending on your interpretation of that, this mighty one who stands and begins to unleash the wrath of God, stands with a rainbow over his head, which promises redemption to us. What an amazing, amazing thing. And that's just a little taste of the biblical theology of something, you know, and of how we learn, how we grow from it, and how it begins in a story in the Old Testament and a promise and a covenant. And so we see its sign. Okay, I'll come back and we'll do that next week. I'm going to take 2 or 3 minutes to ask questions. Noah, humorous. There's no rainbow around your head, son. You cut off the recording for us.